If you are a fan of the Dive Bar Rockstar podcast and would like to help support the show, there's a great way that you can do that and start a new fashion trend. We have a new merchandise page on the website, which features t-shirts and hoodies that are available for sale on Amazon. Just click on merchandise in the top menu and all of the links will be there, or go directly to divebarrockstar.com/merchandise. Get started early on your Christmas shopping at divebarrockstar.com. Welcome to the Dive Bar Rockstar Podcast, a show exploring the lives of professional musicians of all types, touring musicians, recording artists, songwriters, engineers, bar bands, wedding bands, and anyone making their living in the music industry. Whether you've dreamed of being a professional or you already are one, this is the podcast for you. I'm your host, Eric Baines, and I hope that you not only find some entertainment here, but also some helpful tips, trade secrets, and ideas that will help you achieve your dreams. Well, hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm coming to you today from sunny Nashville, Tennessee. And I guess I have sort of an announcement to discuss. Maybe I don't want to make it that dramatic, but I have relocated with my family out here to the great state of Tennessee. And I'm living just on the outskirts of Nashville, about 25 minutes from downtown. And it's kind of a big deal because, I talk a lot about Los Angeles on this podcast, and I love Los Angeles with all my heart and will forever be in its debt. That city gave me everything pretty much, including this beautiful Nashville house that we were able to purchase with the proceeds from selling our tiny Van Nuys house. So Los Angeles, the gift that's kept on giving. But you know, you have a child and needs change and priorities change, and you know, quality of life becomes a little bit more a priority. And Nashville so far and kind of immediately seems to provide a much more family friendly life, you know, it's kind of built into the machine here. So it's incredible how much easier just living with a child and being a musician has been. But it is something that I have hesitated to talk about, because as a musician, I just want to work, and I'm back and forth to Los Angeles all the time. So I don't want to just tell everybody, hey, don't call me anymore because I'm out, because I'm just a flight away. I have accommodations there still. I was just there last week, you know, doing gigs and some production work. So it's an interesting situation to be in. And so I've hesitated to really talk about it. And some people know, some people don't know. But I think it's time to just to put it out there. And I'm excited. I'm excited for the future. I'm excited for this town. So far, like I said, it's just been amazing. And I'm excited for the podcast. I think this will open up some doors and make it a broader experience, not just Los Angeles. Already last episode, I had Tony Obrada from the band Chicago, and he lives here in Nashville. And my guest today is a very talented singer-songwriter, originally from San Luis Obispo, California. She now lives in Nashville, where she plays music for a living and raises her son. She has a great record out called Calico, which we will talk all about, and I highly recommend you check it out. She is just, it's amazing. She's a very, very, very talented songwriter, singer. And the record is just, the production's beautiful. It's really, really cool. She has several albums out, in fact, that you can check out on Spotify or any streaming network. She was in a very special version of Spring Awakening on Broadway, which was nominated for a Tony. And she's sung songs on shows like Love Island and HBO's Newsroom. She's been a friend of mine since she was 16, I think. And she's a great singer. She's a great songwriter and a great artist. So please enjoy my talk with Katie Boak. I want to start with kind of an embarrassing question for me. It seems embarrassing because I've known you for years.
20 years
almost.
Like
since you were a kid, yeah. Even. you know. But how do you pronounce your last name?
It's so funny that I'm actually considering changing it because I've like recently had some like buzz on the folk circuit and nobody can pronounce my last name. It's technically pronounced Boak, like one syllable.
Mm-hmm. Which is what I always said, yeah. Which I'm relieved by.
But. Yeah, but it's like Boak, Beck. I don't know. It's a German weird name. And, you know, I actually recently went on to Ancestry.com because I'm like, if I'm going to change my name, like I want to dig through my history and I want to like find something that isn't like, it just feels arbitrary. Like, I don't know. I thought maybe I could find like, but they're all so weird. Like it's just like Gottlieb and right. Like, you know, I'm like. I
like
found
super
nothing.
German.
Just it gets more German as I go further back. So, right. But I am considering it or like a moniker just because it does feel a bit like an impediment. And part of me is like, well, if the music is there, like, I don't know, Sarah Bareilles or whatever, like people will learn it. But it has right. Like, I won this songwriting competition. They're announcing it to all these people. And it's like, Katie, how do you say it? Like that was how they announced it. And I'm just like, oh, facepalm.
Oh, that's yeah. Funny. I think it's a great name. And Katie Boak, it's very powerful. Boom, boom.
I like that it's symmetrical. It's like five letters and they're like bookended with K's. Like there's a lot that I do like about it. It's just like,
I wouldn't change it. You just got to teach people.
Yeah. I'm like, I've started just writing in parentheses like on my social media accounts, like just B-O-K-E, like and just so that people like, I'm like,
right.
I'm just going to teach people now how to say
right.
It.
Right. Yeah. Or maybe like B-O-H-K or something, like something still cool, but like, a little more obvious. I don't know.
Yeah. This is my conundrum. I know.
Okay. Well, sorry to start off just hitting a nerve.
No, it's okay.
This isn't supposed to be controversial.
We're learning. We're teaching people.
Yeah, exactly. We're getting the words out. The word out. So we knew each other back in Los Angeles. And here I go stepping around the idea that I've moved to Nashville, which I haven't really talked about. So I don't know.
To tell people.
I don't know how much I'll edit out of this, but. And so you moved from Los Angeles to Nashville.
Actually, in between was New York.
Oh, right.
I did a little stint on Broadway. That's yeah, right. But yeah, I've been here almost 7 years now, almost as long as I was ever in LA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you like it?
I love it. I do. I really like it. Yeah. It feels like home.
And
maybe it's because I'm a little older, like just, you know, and I have my son here who was born here. So I feel like I've been in the house I've been in now for like almost 4 years, which is the longest I've been in any one place for the past my adult life. So,
wow.
Yeah, I do like it. And there's a really sweet community here. And I came here because I had spent time in LA in the music scene there. I'd been to New York and I really wanted to just kind of dive into my songwriting more deeply. And I felt like I could come here and the reverence for the craft was like what I was searching for. So,
right.
Yeah.
No, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the things I'm excited about being here. It's because I've written songs obviously for my whole life, but lately I've just, you know, it's like you hit your head against the wall so many times and I get a little less inspired to do it now. I'm like, why? No one's begging me to make a record, you know?
This has been my journey. I similarly hit a place where I just was convinced I didn't have it in me anymore. And I've been on a really intentional journey actually to like recover my creativity and like really refine my voice as a writer.
That's great.
Yeah.
And I feel like, I don't know yet, but what I've heard is, you know, like it's such a muscle here. It's a business. It's more of a craft, or at least it's equally craft as inspiration, you know, which can work in your favor if you're needing like motivation.
You know, there's like the Nashville songwriter way, which is like, you know, the setup and the turn of phrase and the music row kind of thing. And I definitely have explored that path. And there's a lot of literature and philosophy around that. And I feel like I wanted to be able to do that and feel like I flexed that muscle. And so like having now like really dug into that, now it's just like, how do I take those tools and then come back to that sort of childlike, like, cause I'm not that interested in like writing in a room of 15 people for like the music row hit banker kind of thing.
Right.
And that is a totally awesome skill to have. But I think I'm just trying to like salad bar my way through all these techniques and like yeah, just mm-hmm. then come back to me. Like, I've mm-hmm. made it where I've made it, however far that is, like, basically just on instinct and like blind naivete and
a massive amount of talent.
Well, but nothing that was like ever cultivated intentionally. But that's what I've sort of been really digging into with my journey now, is like, how can I now with, it's like full circle, you know, like having come back to this place, I literally feel like my career is just now starting. Like, I'm like, oh, yeah. Wow, these 20 years that I spent going through every winding road, now I understand the assignment, as the kids say. And I'm like, okay, now I get it. And I can go back to my sort of childlike, the dream, the original seed of what started me on this journey, but with all the wisdom and experience of what I've picked up along the way.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm 52 years old now, and I'm just figuring it out. I feel like I'm that's so, yeah. Oh, now I understand the assignment. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, cause like, I think my most recent like experience with making a record was like, I realized that I could basically work with any producer to make something, I guess, objectively beautiful or good. But like, again, it's like, what is my voice and who am I coming into and what are these songs meaning and what am I saying ultimately? And especially now, like with this culture where it's just really focused on productivity and content and stuff, like mm-hmm. I think we overlook like how long it actually does take and like the like the pressure to like have made it by a certain age. Like, I'm really leaning into the writers that I like Lucinda Williams and you know, Sean Colvin, these writers who like maybe like it was a later in life sort of deal for them, but the craft and the like the perspective that you have that you can only get with experience. Like, I'm just interested in that more now. And so I really like the beautiful part about it is that I think I've just sort of detached from my original notion of the dream and like, and I'm excited now about like what is going to like the fruit of just taking my time and slowing down and making something that I'm super proud of, that I have the utmost confidence in, that I can stand behind.
Right.
Even if I'm 50, whatever, by the time, you know, someone recognizes it, I have like satisfaction about my own pursuits of like what I, you know, my own voice.
No, that's awesome. I mean, I think that's the key to life, honestly. Yeah. Like, that kind of happened to me during the pandemic. It's just like, I got to this place where I was, you know, I had gotten pretty far in my career, you know, and bought a house and bought a studio and having a baby. And like, it was like, you know, I've done everything that I kind of set out to do, you know, with exceptions, but like, it was such a freeing thing. And so now I'm like, well, if I end up like on a cool corporate job next year, I don't even care now. Like, I don't have this drive that just sort of becomes like your slave driver, you know, like, I'm just like open now to whatever life has to hand me, you know.
And it's, when you get those external boxes checked, it's like, what is the artist in you like craving at that point? And it's nice when you can like, I play corporate shows and that allows me to like pursue my artist thing. And I used to have a lot of misgivings about that, like, oh, I'm selling out or something like that. And it's like, no, like, I know, like, there's a lot of paths to get there. And I think I've just let myself have and carve my own path and not really do a lot of comparing, which has been so freeing.
Yeah. And I think that it's like, it's the illusion that you're in control. It can mess you up, you know, because that's the once you're free from that and now you're just kind of taking it as it comes, but you're still setting your intentions and you're writing good songs and you're making good music, you know, it's going to work itself out anyways, you know, it's probably, I don't know, who knows? It's hard to tell, but it's probably going to end up where you're supposed to end up regardless. So you might as well relax a little bit and enjoy the ride. You know?
Absolutely. That's like the key. I think that like, I always say, you know, it's fine to set goals and have intentions, but just always leave a little bit of room for the unimaginable. Because in my experience, it's never, the way of getting to my destination has always involved detours and unexpected twists and turns. And it's like, huh, if I would have just not been stressing the whole time, I probably could have enjoyed that journey so much more. So I'm really trying to lean into that.
Right. Yeah. And you've had a crazy journey, like as diverse as I think my career sort of path has been, Yours is crazy.
Yeah, it continues to surprise me. I mean, yeah, I met you when I was 16. I'd been gigging at like a local steakhouse with my stepdad and like an old fiddle player. And somehow that connected me to our mutual friend, Bobby, who was a producer in LA. And
Bobby Williams.
Yeah.
Who's passed now.
Yes. Yeah. I think about him all the time, even more so now, which we can chat about if you want. But yeah, like made a record with him, met you, and that was really my first experience, professional experience.
Yeah.
And then I went to UCLA and I studied theater, and yeah, it's been a long and winding road.
Well, let's start with UCLA.
Okay.
Because you went as a musical theater person, which compared to your records feels just the opposite of who you are in a certain sense. Like, theater is sing to the back of the room and big and huge, and your records are very intimate and up close to the mic. And was that a challenge for you, or what brought you there?
Yeah, well, you know, theater was like my safe place. I think growing up, like I had a really thriving program. So it was just where I found my people and there was just a stage there for me. Mm. But as I started to develop my voice as a writer, I think that I started writing songs when I was like 15, and I think it was just the natural path. Like, I was just like, well, I'm going to audition for these programs, and I got in. And for sure, once I got there, I definitely confronted, because it was like, I had this whole background as like, I love folk music and Laurel Canyon, that whole West Coast folk scene. Like, that was where my heart lived. And then you get to, you're the big fish in the small pond, and then you go to this huge school and you've got like, you know, big Ethel Merman type of singers. I think that was the beginning of the breakdown of my identity and the rebuilding of it. And I found my niche there, and I definitely had success. But then, I joined an a cappella group. I participated in like this big student produced concert, Spring Sing, which really was like, that was all original music. So I was sort of able to find my way. But once I graduated, it was like, no, I'm doing music. Like, I was burnt out on theater. I didn't really want to like put on my character shoes and my jewel tone dress and, you know, hit the streets auditioning. And what's ironic is the way that I found my way to Broadway, which I was not trying to do, was that I got cast in a role that required me to play guitar and to sing. And the material was very folk based. So it was just totally in my wheelhouse. It was just the right opportunity. And yeah, not a thing that I was pursuing, but I felt like I had justified all the money I'd spent on a theater degree. Like, okay, I did the Broadway thing, and it was grueling and I learned a lot, but the piece itself was like really beautiful and really the right thing for me. So just another roundabout way of getting somewhere without, you know, really trying.
So you're talking about Spring Awakening.
Right.
Which is Duncan Sheik. But it was like a different version of that because there was deaf people involved.
Yeah, it was through a theater company in LA called Deaf West, which is an amazing company that works with deaf and hard of hearing actors. And they do musicals, which, you know, you might think like, how is that even possible? But it's totally possible and totally wonderful and totally amazing. And so I was hired as the voice of Vendla, who was the kind of main female character. And I shared the role with Sandra May Frank, wonderful actress, deaf actress. And so she used American Sign Language and I sang and matched my voice to her signing for the dialogue and the songs, and sort of shadowed her on stage while playing the guitar. So yeah, Duncan Sheik, amazing music. And what was so cool about that version of the show was that if you know the show, it's essentially about the breakdown in the communication between adults and children when it comes to talking about like sex and stuff. And so the deaf element like really just enhanced the story. So it was super cool. Yeah, wonderful experience, creative time for me.
And how did that come about?
I had, for whatever reason, like started sharing some of my original music on Twitter, like back when I was on Twitter, and I had some friends like in the theater scene. Like I went to college with my best friend, Nicolette Robinson, who's married to Leslie Odom Jr. And somehow, like, my video had been shared around, and the director of the show, Michael Arden, had seen it and just essentially asked me to do it. We started because he was looking for a female singer guitarist. Mm-hmm. We did it for, it was at this place called Inner City Arts, like on Skid Row in LA. We made $20 a show, brought our own costumes. It was so low budget.
Wow.
But it was just one of those lightning in a bottle, magical, beautiful pieces of art that got really good reviews and transferred to the about a bigger theater in Beverly Hills, the Wallace Annenberg. And a Broadway producer came and saw that show and brought us to New York for a limited run for like 6 months in the Brooks Atkinson Theater in New York. So it was just like an underdog story, just started from the bottom, made our way to Broadway, and then we were nominated for Best Revival at the Tonys.
And, right, yeah. And so, did you, I seem to remember you opened the Tonys.
I didn't open the Tonys.
Like, it was you.
Okay, yeah. Oh my gosh, it was so gnarly.
Like,
so,
I watched it.
Yeah, and me being a deer in the headlights with Oprah right there.
No.
Yeah, no, basically, it didn't seem like that. So most of that stuff is pre-recorded. You know, you go in the studio and you pre-record, and then everyone lip syncs. Mm-hmm. And for the 30 seconds that I was playing the guitar and singing the first, you know, piece of Mama Who Bore Me completely live. And they were like, you're going to be live. And then the remainder of it is going to be. And I was just like,
lucky me.
I mean, my heart was pounding. It was horrifying, but amazing. And, you know, it's one of those things where, like, I wish I could kind of go back with what I know now and bring that level of, like, of confidence and the tools I have to, like, regulate my body when I'm in that kind of high stakes position. But, you know, like, I did it, and it was cool.
Well, it didn't come across that way at all.
Just heart pounding.
Just like, wait, that's her.
I know. Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean,
musically, that show, I felt like I was in heaven. There's so many beautiful different guitar tunings in that show. We were sponsored by Gibson, I think, and we just played all these beautiful guitars, and it was like a guitar player's dream. Like, and what's funny is I'd written off ever being in that show because I felt like I'd outgrown it as far as like my age. And so another thing, like, you just never ever know what version of something's going to come up and what your special skill you have, like, that will allow you to be in something. So,
wow, that's really good. So did you get to work with Duncan Sheik?
He did. He came and kind of facilitated some of the sessions, and he was there for the Broadway portion of it. Yeah, in a really kind of classy way. Like, he was just stewarding us as the musicians. There was several of us who were in that same type of role, like, who were the voicing counterparts to the actors who were also in the band, kind of roving on stage. So he was really helpful for us. Yeah.
That's cool.
Like, this is like the strumming pattern for this thing, you know? Yeah.
Oh, got you. Very cool. Yeah, I'm kind of a fan.
Oh, man.
were you a fan? Yeah, yeah. That whole record. Like, the first three records, I just wore them out.
Yeah. I was definitely like, it was a little bit like, working with someone who you've like grown up listening to their music in the 90s. Like,
I'm kind of familiar with that feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. You're on tour with freaking Chicago right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I get it. It's pretty exciting. It kind of makes you feel like, I did something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what an honor and a privilege to kind of be invited into something that at one point you like really had a lot of reverence for. And
yeah.
I have an acoustic piano upright in my house that was given to me by a friend here who was leaving town. And apparently it used to belong to Chicago, the band.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
I don't know.
Oh, that's cool.
I know, yeah. So that's what I've been writing all my stuff on.
Sweet. Yeah, yeah, it's in there. You got a little Saturday in the Park.
Yeah, song. Exactly.
That was awesome. So it was never like your big, huge dream to be on Broadway, even though you did the musical theater, or?
I mean, I think there's just a version of me that like could have gone down that path more so. So I have a lot of satisfaction about having gotten to experience that and in the way that I did. But I would never move back to New York and just start grinding and being like, can I be in like West Side Story? Like, that's not, I'm not interested in like telling those stories. If someone came along with a new contemporary piece that was in my wheelhouse that you know, like I like acting and I like being on stage and I like telling stories. And I mean, the performance and the audience and the exchange there, it's different than a music show where people are sometimes drinking beer and talking and whatever. Like,
right.
I like the...
It's more wine in a Broadway play.
Yeah, more wine and, you know, yeah, wine and cheese. It's just like, it, they're there and they're sitting and they're just, you know, it's more of a listening audience and a different kind of exchange happening. And I, you know, there's kind of a trend now with like female singer-songwriters writing musicals like Sarah Bareilles with Waitress or Ingrid Michaelson now with The Notebook. Like, I wouldn't mind doing that at some point in my career. Telling, you know, you applying what I do as Katie with my musical voice to a beautiful story.
Right.
So who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But pretty cool.
Yeah. It was cool. It was totally
Did you like
cool.
New York?
I loved it. Especially, you know, like having a Broadway paycheck. Like that's really the way that I want to do it. And it wasn't like I was living in the lap of luxury. I mean, rent is, you know, extraordinarily expensive. But yeah, like I lived for the majority of it in Hell's Kitchen, like a few blocks from the theater. So it's just a sweet little life, you know, like waking up. I mean, it's grueling and brutal. The schedule is not like there's people who are Broadway people and they go from show to show to show and 8 shows a week. I mean, we performed on Christmas. You know, if you get sick, it's high stress. It's like you're always maintaining your instrument. So, I mean, it wasn't like... It was hard. Like it wasn't and it was fun, but it's work. It's grueling work.
Right. Yeah. I kind of can't imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I sort of can. I mean, we do like 2.5 hours but I don't do the heavy lifting as a singer. We have a lead singer who does all the high stuff. So I sing 3-4 tunes, you know, but even just that is like, you know, for years I didn't really tell people I could sing because
you can sing
because I enjoyed drinking,
right? Yeah,
so I didn't want to tell you know,
the pressure.
If I can just play bass, I can drink as much as I want,
Because otherwise, you'd be like, if people know you have a skill, they're like, all right, let's utilize it
exactly.
But especially
if you can do 2 things because then you cover 2 chairs, you know,
and just like, save them that extra paycheck.
But now that I'm like older and I've got a kid, it's like I can't do the kind of drinking that I used to enjoy anyways. Now I'm like, okay, it's time to take care of yourself and get on stage every night and
you have such an amazing voice. Like it's funny when you talk about like not fully disclosing all your skills. That's definitely a thing on Broadway, like swings. You know, if you're a person who can cover multiple tracks and like memorize lines and you can, you know, remember blocking, like those are the ones that end up getting cast in swing roles, which isn't as glamorous as like, you know, if you're like more of a unique or nuanced performer and you're really only this type, you know, then you end up getting those kinds of lead roles. So it's just an interesting thing knowing what you have the ability for versus like what you really want to be doing and what kind of career you want to carve for yourself. Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
So kind of figure out who you are and be that if you can.
Yeah. And like,
even in a Broadway setting.
Right. Yeah. I mean, because you are the author of like your own story. And I think when you start off young, you're just so eager and hungry to get like whatever you can. But then what I've come to find out, like once you're on a path, like the opportunities that you get are born from that road that you're on. And so like even for me, it's like I can sing and play covers in my own style. And it was like once a bunch of like big time like private event luxury wedding planners heard me, it's like I could, oh, this is a path. I guess suppose I could go make my bread and butter only doing this. But then it's like you have to
kind of, for years.
And I do that. But like I've had to really protect my artistic heart too, because you know, there's like a term in that world is like, those are the golden handcuffs because there's the money, whatever. But you know, you blink and 10 years of that goes by and it's like, dang, I haven't actually, there is a finite amount of time. And like, how many more covers am I going to learn versus how am I going to have boundaries around like my daytime working hours, especially as a mom now, like, actually, I really want to be using this time to write. So I'm going to start saying no. Unless this is the number and if it's feasible for me. So that's been a big thing I've been learning too. Like,
right.
Cause yeah, I could probably be making more money or whatever doing that, but I really, I'm invested in like my artistic voice and my writing. And so I have to have stronger boundaries around making space for that. Cause I'm the only one who's going to make space for my inner creative world. Cause yeah, like I said, once you're on that road, you know, you've swung before and you know how to cover many roles. Great. It kind of happened to me in the Broadway world. Once it was like known that I was the guitar playing actress, my agents would only send me those roles. And it's like, you know, I've studied Shakespeare. Like I would like the opportunity to do a non-musical, but it was like, nope, you get niched and that's great for some things. But yeah, so.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's another reason I didn't want to tell people I sing. Cause I'm like, that's my thing.
Yeah.
Like that, I write and sing my own stuff. I'll play bass on whatever you want. You know, I'm a total hooker when it comes to that.
Right.
You know, but
yeah.
But this is my thing, you know. So it's fun. It's fun to now to be in a band where what I do fits what they do so well that it is, I guess it's the same situation. Yeah. It's like I don't have to pretend. I'm just, these are the songs I love anyways. You know what I mean?
Such a good feeling.
And my voice fits right there, you know, so I don't have to be anything else. You know?
And like that, you start, the older you get, the more you start to really feel the cost of that, of like not only physically, but like now if I go play like a 4-hour cover gig, I'm like, I've lost something. Unless there's an exchange, like an energetic exchange where I'm like, I'm making several thousand dollars.
Right.
It's like, ooh, it takes from me. And then I have to spend a couple of days like nurturing and recovering like my soul. And I just don't need to do that anymore. It's not worth it. So I think that it's within the right of every artist to really protect what is theirs and what's sacred about what they do, and like how we're using our bodies and our instruments to like, it's bigger than just getting out and like jamming out. Like you are using your vessel and your instrument and your voice to like collectively create synchronization in a room full of people. You're offering a gift, and it's been so undervalued, but we have to kind of protect that.
I mean, beyond like you're the only one's gonna do it,
right?
You know, and the world just wants to exploit you.
People will exploit you if they can. 100%. Yeah.
And I think also as a vocalist first, I would assume, like I've got this bass thing that's really detached. I'm like plucking on strings. It's not really, I didn't even want to play bass. Like I just, nobody else would do it. So I learned and I got good. And when it came time to college, I'm like, well, I'm going to have the best advantage playing this instrument and I can read
on
it.
You were on the path. Yeah.
So I just took it, you know, and it's provided me an incredible life, but you know, but it's easier. I don't feel like I'm whoring myself out as much doing that. Cause it's more like an assembly line skill than singing. That's like me and it's my body. And if you don't like it, you don't like me.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a much more vulnerable, putting yourself out there,
it
you
is.
Know, scary thing. And if it turns into just dollars, then it feels yucky.
Yeah. Yeah. The exchange is not like, money is just the exchange of like hard, you know, what you do for what they do. And so, like when we lose the connection point for it all, it can, really leave you feeling super drained. And I think that happens. Like that's the other thing about like while I'm grateful for my journey, just watching people who have this sort of meteoric rise and then a crash, because it's just like absolutely no tools for sustaining, you know. So I'm really on the slow burn path and I'm happy about that, because I feel like now it's like when I've gone out and played shows and felt the exhaustion or whatever, I'm like, I'm really thinking about like, what kind of songs would I want to be on the road with every night? And like, you know, as amazing as someone as Adele is or whatever, it's like she wrote an entire catalog of songs that is just those are hard songs to sing every night. And so I've been really thinking about that for myself. Like, how do I want to feel? Like, if I'm going to create my career, like what songs are going to feel really good for me to play every night and that are sustainable for me? And so it's just fun to think about it like that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for me, it was manifested as anger. I was angry for a long time. Like even the Brass Elephant, where you probably first saw me play, which was this divey, dive bar rock star is based a lot in my head on that bar. You know?
I was hoping we would talk about the Brass Elephant today. Yeah.
And but even there, it's like, you know, I played with Bobby Williams, who we previously talked about, and he's a guitar player, singer.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun because I never had to, Well, I don't want to say never. When I first moved to town, it was one of the first gigs I got. So at that time, every $120 mattered, you know, like it was like, oh my gosh, I can pay a bill or eat, you know, but eventually it was just like where I went and had fun on the weekends if I wasn't working. I always had a gig.
And money or not, it was like, you know, sort of irrelevant.
But even that would get like, you know, I grew up doing bar work. That's where I started, you know, so, and until I got to the Brass Elephant, really, I wasn't a drinker. So I hated drunks. And every night I was like, all I am is a beer salesman, you know, and it just, it killed me for a long time. It took, you know, probably decades for me to not be that angry person that was mad at my audience, really, which was a big lesson, is a big lesson to me every day. Cause now I have like, these Chicago fans are just glorious people. And, you know, and it's like, if you don't, you can't be mad at your audience and expect them to like you.
You know right. What I mean? And so that's why environment is so important. I mean, yeah, I've played my fair share of bar gigs too. And it's like, I think it's a trap some artists fall into when they come to Nashville, like, where can I immediately make money? And it's like, all right, I'm going down to Broadway. And I mean, I played down there. I've kind of found my local joints that are like, that I think have audiences and environments that appreciate like my more subdued thing. Like I'm not going down there singing like, you know, I don't know, Brick
friends
House or
places.
Friends in Low Places. Yeah, that's more like it. But there are people I think
fishing
like,
in the dark.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Or just like, man, happy you like.
Right. Yeah.
But there are people where like that's out of necessity, like that's where you find your way. I just think it's really important for people to have a trajectory and like a and real strong boundaries. I really wish that the like Broadway artists would unionize or something, because like we just get totally, you know, there's just like, because there's always someone new coming in to take the gig.
Yep.
And it's just saturated, you know, there's really no uniting.
And, you know, the danger of it becoming like, you know, the Sunset Strip where it becomes pay to play is there when you have so many people just willing to play for nothing because they want to be a big star.
Yeah.
You know,
it's kind of a trap.
The talent comes down. Like even, you know, I've been coming to Nashville for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. And because I was with Dwight Yoakam for 5 years. So
I didn't know you were with Dwight Yoakam. How did I miss that?
Yeah. A lot of people did. I don't know.
Because
no one would ever guess I would be a country guy.
No, but he's so special. He's so good.
Yeah.
My dad used to play
time.
Him, and I was always like, I never was just sidebar, was like, I never appreciated his voice. And I would always be like, Dad, I don't like Dwight. And then now as an adult, I'm like, I get it. I'm like, Dwight Yoakam is so special. Yeah.
Yeah, and some of those the later records, like he won Grammys for singing, you know, like
that honky tonk thing, you know, like it borderlines like there's a whole scene here in Nashville with like the honky tonk Tuesday night thing at the American Legion, and it's a little bit like, I don't know, do you know this term LARPing, where it's like cosplaying in sort of some nostalgia thing, and there's a little bit of that to it where it's like there's this sort of nostalgia for the bygone days where it was like wholesome, and you get these people that show up that are like straight out of the 50s, and it's a honky tonk. Like it is, it's like walking into another world.
Right.
And so there's a bit of a fine line there for me with the Nashville scene where it's like, you can kind of like become a cartoonish caricature
version
of it.
Yeah.
Whereas like,
especially because it's touristy. And people kind of come here wanting a little taste of that.
Oh, yeah. Show me like, where are the people that are like, where's real country Nashville or whatever.
Right.
But so for me, the distinction there is just like the songs, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't care what you look like, what you dress like.
Yeah.
If the songs are there and it's, I mean, in the 50s, those songs were, I was just talking about this with someone today about like, has there ever been a time when the quality of art was matching what the public was appreciating? And it feels like those eras where Willie Nelson's writing great songs or like Roger Miller, those were hit songs and the crafting was so excellent. Whereas now it feels like there's an underground thing, you know, we've just lost sight of that. And so I hope that we can, I want people to have like standards around what we're giving our,
which is kind of just what I was going to say. It's like, I've watched the sort of talent on Broadway kind of wane over the last 7 years or so of coming here once or twice a year. And that's another danger. That's just like the Sunset Strip. Once you start having, once the bars realize, oh, I can just have any band in here and the drunk tourists are going to dig it, then mm-hmm. here's a band that's won't take as much money, but right. they're also not going to be as talented, you know?
That's why I think like the individual's journey is so important, like the artistic inner thing, like because social media has contributed to it too a little bit of just like, I got to get this person's attention in 5 seconds. So mm-hmm. what like mm-hmm. shticky thing am I going to do? Yeah. And it's really unfortunate. It is like sort of causing, I think, like the slow erosion of quality, because I think yeah. that it's just quality is arrived at with just more time and yeah. real introspection and real yeah. thoughtfulness. And so when that's not valued, I mean, things just go downhill. So,
yeah. And like, speaking of like, how to just put it, like popular music and art being...
Oh, like when the audience good. And the, yeah, yeah.
Oh, you said it way better. I'll go back and redo it. But anyway, like that's, you know, I play with Chicago once again, and it's like listening to those early songs and I'm like, this was on the radio. Like, this is amazing, incredible art by teenagers that, you know, in early 20s making this brilliant music mm-hmm. and it was on the radio, or Led Zeppelin, or like, you know, I mean, there's definitely, you can, it always makes you sound like an old person, but like, come on, you know, like you can see the arc from, you know, the 60s and the Beatles all the way down to, you know, I don't know, actually I feel like right now things are getting a little better, like Dua Lipa and stuff like that, the pop stuff, there is better stuff.
It's happening. A little more in depth, yeah.
But I think pre-pandemic it was a party rock anthem, oh, and yeah. like, you know, Pitbull, it's like come
Black
on
Eyed Peas,
like this, like, is, yeah, like yeah, it's yeah. not, this isn't even, they're not even songs, they're just phrases,
yeah, and beats synths, and interesting, you know, and, sounds, yeah. Yeah, that's, I think, why the music from the 70s is like still so revered. There's something yeah. magical about that time. Like yeah. people were taking risks creatively and
being rewarded for it.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Like, so I don't know what happens. I don't know yeah. if it's just like I don't know if it's connected to like just corporatism and, you know, the exchange, like those being hand in hand, like artists and corporations and needing to sell, like yeah. it felt like that wasn't happening. Like I can't imagine like James Taylor being like selling, I don't know, like, and maybe it was in its own way, but yeah, there's something yeah. there, I think, about why it was so yeah. good and distinct. They were, yeah. artists were free to yes. really say what they.
And it was new and people are like, what is that? And now yeah. it's like the science of the music business has narrowed it down to what's the lowest common denominator that the most
mass
people will
appeal,
buy.
Right. Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it sucks.
It's sad.
It is sad. Yeah. But you know, you can get really like down on it, but then it's just like, what else is there to do? Then like get that pen and that paper out yeah. and like try yeah. to write something that's going to really touch people.
And now you have access to people like you never did as an artist. It takes, it's time consuming. It's so against your creative nature. Ooh. But at the same time, if you have 10,000 fans and they buy a record once a year, you know,
I love
for 20
that,
bucks,
like math,
you know, or whatever,
the
you know,
of that. It's
yeah,
like
and
you
buy
actually,
merch
yeah.
and they come to your shows. You don't need millions of people anymore. You just have access to fans that really want
yeah,
to buy your music
and
support you.
Yeah, and in some ways, like when people really do make it, they do become beholden to what they've already done, because it's like, we know this sells. And I just, yeah. I would love to have a career like you're talking about, where it's like, maybe I'm playing smaller performing arts centers or listening yeah. rooms, but I have a loyal following and that following of people is with me on my journey and they're excited about whatever new avenue I'm going to go down and explore. And
yeah.
so that's the kind of thing I'm trying to create. Yeah.
yeah. I'm a die-bar rock star. I have to confess something. I love books, but I don't love reading. And it's been something that I've wrestled with since I was a kid. You know, I can read, I have read books, but they're very time consuming and I've spent most of my time trying to build a music career, which takes a lot of time. But one thing I definitely do a lot of is drive in LA traffic on my way to a gig. And there's a solution that combines those two situations, and it's called Audible.com. Audible has thousands of audiobook titles, and you can listen offline anywhere, anytime. The app is free and can be installed on all smartphones and tablets. And they have just a ton of music-related titles, like All You Need to Know About the Music Business by Donald S. Passman, How Music Works by David Byrne, or Music Production Secrets by Calvin Carter. And you can get a free 30-day trial right now if you visit audibletrial.com/divebarrockstar. That's audibletrial.com/divebarrockstar. I'd like to take a second and thank you for listening to the Dive Bar Rockstar podcast. Getting the word out is a vital part of what it takes to keep this show on the road, and the easiest way to help is to subscribe wherever you listen, and if you have an extra minute or two, please leave a review. You can also follow our page on Facebook, which is the Dive Bar Rockstar podcast, or follow me on Instagram at Dive Bar Rockstar. Okay, enough begging. I hope you're having a great time, and once again, thank you for listening. I know it's a year old now, I think, but let's talk about your, this is your last record, right?
Yeah, the most recent one.
Yeah, Calico.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Thanks.
Very beautiful.
Thanks.
Very cool record. I really loved it.
Yeah.
It's an interesting progression. I don't know.
Yeah, from having seen like what I'd done with Bobby in those years, and then I made one EP in between. I know. I mean,
this is when I feel like you hit the mark or you hit your stride. You know,
yeah.
Like, that's what it feels like. I don't know what it feels like to you.
I mean, I could spend a whole other podcast talking about that and my relationship with the producer and how it came to be. It was definitely fraught, and I learned a lot. I am really proud of it. I needed to do something like that. Like, for myself, like I had, you know, in the years between the EP that I put out in 2014 and that record, so much life has happened. Like I lost my dad, and then I like had a baby, and then I got divorced. And so I just needed to make something to know that I could again.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, I'm proud of it. It definitely is a moment in time in my life. I think it's beautiful. It was definitely really collaborative, you know, with the producer. So I think I'm
Dustin Ransom.
Yeah. So I'm having to like really have a lot of grace with myself. And I think that having done that now, like now where I'm at is like a little bit more of a return to like who I was when I met Bobby. And it's like, I'm back to like writing on the piano a little bit more and just like, kind of what I was just referring to earlier, just that full circle, like, you know, and this is like a little bit of a tangent about like women in the industry and like having autonomy and agency and like, you know, like I'm not a producer, so I'd like to be, and I'd like to have the freedom to sit at my console and make my voice and my guitar sound the way that I want to. But there's a barrier there for me a little bit with technology and, you know, no excuses. Like I could and have taken some courses and made myself more familiar, but there's some real delicateness there when it comes to like who you're bringing into your creative space and how much of your like agency you're handing over. Like, here, can you, you know, are you going to like, he just played the instruments, you know, I'm a guitarist. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a pretty good one, but you know, like it, so there's a lot about it that, I would do differently, you know what I mean? And that I learned and like, that I now like want to have more confidence around as far as like my artistic ideas and, even compositionally, you know? So, but I do think that we landed somewhere. It's just crazy. Like you can make anything. Like art is so wild. Like you have a vision, you go in a studio and that combination of sounds and words just results in the album. And so I think like now having just a little bit clearer vision and like more intention and really just about taking away layers and distilling it into the thing that feels the most honest. So but I am proud of it. I'm really proud of it.
Because I was going to say there's so much of it is simple too. Like the over again.
Yeah.
It's very... The production is really vibey and cool, but there's not a lot there, you know, it's just as far as being stripped down.
Yeah, we really intentionally were like, we were going to just start with five elements, like acoustic guitar, bass, drums, piano, Wurlitzer. Like that was the only sounds I really wanted on the record. And so we did that. Like it's an acoustic record for sure, but it's also like very cosmic and has like other layers to it. That song in particular feels like the standout sort of triumph for me as a writer and a vocalist. And we did that like one take, like vocally, that just kind of all happened in the moment. And I do, I like it as a song. I like how it feels. And that was the first one we wrote for the record and first single, and to kind of set the tone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I always said it would take losing me for you to be the one I'd choose. A hopeless warning though, when you don't know the worth of what you stand to lose. And I could feel my heart descending into fires of the deepest blue. I was burning at the stake, and that was never good enough for you. Happy end. Nothing left to make except amends, 'cause love's another story and you can't pretend. You wouldn't do it different if you could do it over again.
And he's a percussion player.
He's an everything player, but yeah he studied percussion at Belmont, but yeah, I mean, please.
That's another thing that like struck me listening to it.
Yeah.
Like rhythmically, mm-hmm. it's really cool.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this got this sort of subtle undertones of just funky, groovy stuff,
yeah.
but it's not like in your face. Some of them, like Endgame.
That's such a wild song. Yeah.
Very percussive.
He
very
went
cool,
a little off
very
the rails on
hippie
that
jam.
One.
Like,
yeah.
Very,
yeah. We did a lot like with just like, yeah, letting things breathe a little bit in certain spaces on the record. I think what I'm finding about myself as like an artistic identity is like groove has always been like kind of an undercurrent of what I enjoy doing. It's kind of my natural thing as I sort of find a groove and then weave my melodies around it. And so I think that he took that and ran with it. And because, you know, percussion is his thing, we really like leaned into that pretty heavily on it. Yeah.
But it's cool. I think it's a different side. Like it's interesting you say that, because I feel like it's always been there. It just wasn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't tended to correctly. How about that?
In LA, when I made my EP, like I feel so lucky about the kind of players that I mean, I got to work with you and Chad and like these amazing, which I didn't even appreciate. I mean, I knew that you guys were like the LA cats, but like Bobby just kind of like put me in your hands and like made this amazing record. And I remember getting like my first mix of Average Jane and my mind blowing. There was this song I wrote when I was like 15 that Bobby produced, and just being like, oh my God, I have no idea my music could sound like this. And then, you know, when I graduated, I had met these other players.
I really love that song, by the way.
Yeah, I know. It's still the one that my mom's like, yeah, that's your hit, Katie.
That's a hit
like,
song right there.
I know. I honestly do feel like it still is like so, it's such a bop. But like I started playing out with like Rob Humphreys, who now is like playing for Casey Musgraves. Like drummers have always been like, if I can't play a show with like a bad drummer. Like if the drumming is not like there for me, I need, like, if I'm going to have players, I need to have a good drummer.
Me too.
Bobby talked a lot to me about that. Like Bobby was the one who was like, you know, Bobby, he was such a critic and his ears, you know what I mean? Like so particular. And, you know, I'd be with people and he'd be like, Pac is just too loose for you. You know, like, great drummer, but just not the one for you. And he really taught me about how to open my ears to the musicians I was choosing. And it's honestly a skill that I'm really proud that I have now, because it's just like, there's so many, especially when you get into a city like Nashville, it's like, take your pick of any incredible musician, but who are the ones that are gonna really be sensitive enough for, he would always use that term, like, you need sensitive players. And so, you know, I have so much reverence in my heart for him. And I actually recently got like super emotional thinking about him and just like all that he was trying to impart to me that I was maybe a little too young to like even understand, you know? And so I have a lot of love for Bobby and all that I learned from him, and hope he's looking down, you know, proud of me now. And
right. I'm sure. Beyond, I mean, you know, okay, we're just going to have a cry fest, I guess. But, you know, the other thing about Bobby, he was a huge Dwight Yoakam fan.
He was, yeah.
He was like, Pete Anderson was Dwight Yoakam's guitar player.
So cool that you went on to play for Dwight then.
Yeah. I mean, it would have blown his mind. And the other thing that I didn't realize, well, because he'd talk to me all the time, I didn't care about country, you know. He'd have it on VH1 and country every time I went to his house. You know, it was like, I get the production value, absolutely, and all that stuff.
Yeah,
just wasn't, I wasn't ready for it. You know what I mean? Plus, I have, you know, my mom was always country growing up, and she drove, so I had all these issues.
But
I get the gig. But anyway, but Bobby would have talked about Pete Anderson all the time, and I was like, Pete Anderson, I don't know, because his. Bobby's playing style came directly from Pete Anderson. Like Dwight Yoakam and Pete Anderson were partners for all the big records. And
Pete Anderson Dwight's bass player from?
No, he was his original guitar player.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
And it's kind of him and Pete were partners for a long time for all the hit records.
Pete
was producing all that stuff and playing the guitar. So, I mean, if you hear those records, listen to the guitar. He's probably the most underrated.
Like guitars, Cadillacs, all that stuff.
Okay. And all those solos. Oh my gosh. Like he was just killer. Insanely great guitar player that I know now, you know, but at the time Bobby was just like obsessed with the dude and this picking style. I just remember him giving me a lecture like Pete Anderson plays with the picking style, and I was like, okay, that's
I'm
great.
Glad I'm not the only one who feels like I just didn't have the, you know, the insight or whatever when he was just trying to be like, Katie, you know, get this to me now, you know?
But it's just interesting. Like, I think about it all. I think about it often, not all the time.
Yeah.
But what he would, you know, because he also had this thing that sort of was, I know he just wanted to challenge me all the time.
He was tricky.
But it becomes like, after a while, you're like, dude, my career's kind of kicking ass and you're not giving me the love that I feel like I should be.
Yeah.
Like, so the other part of me wonders what he would have said. Like, what are you going to say now, dude? I'm playing with Dwight Yoakam.
Right.
You know, I'm on stage with him every night. And like in that gig, singing wise, it was me and him all night. Like I was doing all the high harmonies against him. And
I'm sad that I missed that.
It's all over YouTube.
Okay, I'm gonna check it out. Send me the links. But yeah, no, Bobby, it was like he was never satisfied in a way that was like good for the art, you know, like pushing good, maybe. I mean, I think like anybody who knew Bobby, like that was part of it, was just that he like had unbelievable standards and taste, and he was just loved people and music so much, and really wanted the best for everybody. And so, that's such a wild thing. He had to have something to do with that, maybe, you know?
I know, right? Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
But it turns out, like, there's a Moose Lodge in Burbank that Pete Anderson played every Monday night, you know, and I know he was there for years. Because now I've met him a few times, you know, and I just I wish I'd have known that then, and we could have gone and seen him, you know, like had that moment of, I didn't know, did Bobby know that he was, he's literally up the street right there, you know, like, so,
Bobby always was like, when it came time for me, cause I met Bobby when I was like 15 or 16 and we made a record. And then it was like, I was getting into school and I was debating about going to New York for NYU. And he's like, you got into UCLA, but for a time he was really trying to encourage me to apply to Occidental, which I was like, Occidental, I've never heard of it.
That was a big claim to fame.
But honestly, like looking back, I mean, it's a pretty cool school. Like I wish I would have like had, you know, been keyed in a little bit more to that, because that whole like Pasadena Burbank thing was pretty cool. And I wasn't not on that radar, but.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I know that we went to see you in a play in UCLA, in a musical.
Oh.
I can't remember the name of it. It was on a boat.
Oh, Anything Goes.
Anything Goes.
Yeah, oh gosh, my junior year, yeah.
It was great.
Yeah,
it was great. But it was, you know, I don't know, it's a memory in my head.
Yeah.
Me and Bobby going to see you.
He was
beaming, and he was very proud. And, you know, so I know that he's looking down. I mean, I think he would be pretty impressed with this record.
I think so, too. He'd have lots of notes, I'm sure. But, it actually feels very Bobby-ish to me in a way, just like with the harmonically, like the stuff that he was really into. And he was definitely a big influence on me in that way. And, you know, Bobby, like looking back now, like there's so much I would change and, you know, ways that I wish it would have gone differently. But like, I'll always feel like he heard me and understood me when I was so raw and like really just pretty messy. But like he knew what I was capable of and really believed in me, and that will always hold so much value for me. So
he wouldn't stop talking about me. It's very annoying.
I miss
like,
that
but
guy.
What about me?
I know I know, but he loved you guys too so much.
He was a big-hearted dude, that's for sure.
He
and
was
so many fun nights. That was the good side of the Brass Elephants. Like he didn't care, like he just wanted to be musical. So if you kind of knew a song,
come on up.
Just play it, you know. He'll start a song and you're like, I don't know this song, but just
I just think
musical,
of him singing
cool.
Walking in Memphis. There's like a video of him doing that. And I just loved that.
Wow.
Beautiful guy.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the Joni Mitchell kind of tribute that you do.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
In fact, one time I was here, I tried to see you.
Oh, at Franklin.
We were at the Ryman and you were playing early, like no, you were at, what's the
City Winery?
No, it's the Numbers. It's right on Broadway.
And you were 1230
Club. 1230
Club.
There we go. I'm new here still.
That's right. Yeah.
And I like, I almost hit you up because I was like, oh, we're at the Ryman, like
right next door,
right across the street. And I'm like, oh, I could probably catch it. And it just, the scheduling all got screwed up, but I wanted to just show up and shock you. But
I would have loved that. Yeah.
And that was the Joni Mitchell.
That wasn't.
The
1230 Club is just like, I don't really play there anymore, but it's like a supper club that I just was doing cover gig. It was a cover gig thing, but it was cool. It's a big stage. Like it's got lights. It's really swanky. I feel like a chanteuse when I'm up there, but no, just a Broadway cover thing. But no, the Joni thing, I took that on during COVID. That was kind of my COVID project. I'd known that I'd wanted to do it for a long time. Like back in 2015, I remember, I've always loved that album, but I remember kind of revisiting it again more in depth and looking at the liner notes and being like, huh, it came out in 1971. Like, it's going to be 50 years in 2021. And like, so the seed had been planted. But then, COVID happened and I was like, well, I'm not writing and I've been going through a really challenging time personally. Like, I need some material that is going to like speak to me that I can like wrap myself around and feel something. And so I took on learning all that and learning it on the dulcimer and piano stuff, which like I'm an okay piano player, but it's not like, like I had to sit down and like really wrote, like figure out those songs and her cadence. And then once I'd done that, I just kind of put some assets together and was like, I don't know, semi-tribute-y. I had read so many of her biographies and so I was really proud of what I put together. Like, it's really touching. Someone who saw it said like, that it's like being a flame keeper to like the great material. And I was really, nice. I loved that. I was like, you know, it has its, you know, I'm sure, I don't know, maybe you feel this playing with Chicago, maybe not, but like I have put her on such a pedestal as a writer that like I really had to kind of take a break from it. And I was super ready to find my thing after doing it. But man, yeah, I mean, I'm happy to see that she's getting as much recognition and acclaim as she is. And she's been like a very formative, like musical mother to me. So
yeah,
I'm glad I did it.
I remember talking about that with Bobby too. He was a huge Joni Mitchell fan as well.
I don't know that he and I ever super got into her.
Interesting. Because I think that's what he liked about you
and what he saw in you. Oh, kind of the sort of harmonic, interesting. Yeah, maybe we did then. We had to. I can't imagine. Because I would loved Joni.
And vocally, too. I mean,
yeah, you know, that was the thing when I hear her, the first time I heard her, I felt an immediate kinship to the way she sang and to where our voices sat, like,
right,
and where her break is. Like, I can, you know, so it was fun for me because I could sing really similarly. And so, but what became the ultimate lesson for me with her was, like, I went through a whole complex of, like, I'll never be Joni, and what, this is pointless. And people are so, like, they're such fans of hers, and her music is the kind of thing where you feel like she's speaking directly to you. And so you have like intense, like feelings of like personal connection to her.
Right.
So I was careful not to like do too much outside of like what people were used to. But anyway, what it came to be about for me was like not sounding or being like her, but finding that level of vulnerability and honesty for myself inside the songs. Because I had one show and it was like, well, where are you? You know what I mean? And so it was a whole journey of finding it. But yeah, I think that's what people love the most about her is her transparency. And obviously she's an amazing writer and, you know, lyrically and musically, she did so many things that no one had ever done. But
So you're not doing it anymore?
I have some folks who want to help me produce it and take it like overseas. So the thing about it is just such an ambitious undertaking, especially if I do it the way that I like to do it, which is to play all the songs and have my band, which is just like bass, drums, and a second guitar player and singer. So I'm like holding it down on all that stuff. And so I usually have to set aside like a month to like shed tunes and really get it. And so because it's so much work, like I want to do it, but I want to make it more sustainable for me. Like I want to be making more money. Like I'd love to go out and do 5 shows of it a year in Europe or Australia or something.
Right.
But it is just a big undertaking and it takes a lot of my creative energy. So
yeah.
But I've done it.
And you have a child.
And I have a child. And I'm trying to like, you know, write and stuff like that. So again, it's like different pathways and people get into the tribute thing and like that's their career too, you know?
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I did a lot of it actually when I was in LA because it is such big business now. And like, you know, you make a lot of money, especially like the Joni Mitchell thing. Like
it's marketable.
You know, she's not
going to
be around, you know, too much longer. And once that happens, it ramps it up even more. Like I had a guy that I know does a David Bowie show, and it's when David Bowie died, it was like
calls where
he couldn't do enough gigs. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I mean, I love that I did it. I feel like it was
That I want that to happen.
But it's coming. So we all have to prepare.
But life does work in a certain way.
It's inevitable. But I know that it's always something that's available to me. That's one of those records that I can come back to and continue learning and growing with age. I mean, the last time I saw Richard, like that was always a song that I just dismissed, could have not even began to understand it. And then I got divorced and had a child and I was just like, oh, I get it. I get what this is saying and like how romance and cynicism, you know, like just that idea. And yeah, but I think I also had to be careful, like, how much of this do I want to put into versus, like, what do I have to say and what am I putting out to the world? Like, but I like the idea of flame keepers of the greats because that music should and deserves to be heard and new generations can discover it. And so in that sense, I feel like there's a sense of dutifulness or something, you know, like I can do it and I'm happy to do it and keep it alive. So,
Well, tell me about your podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Since we're doing a podcast.
I know. Everybody's got a podcast. It's really new, but I when I became a mother, I suddenly was awakened to the challenges of just time management. And, you know, I wanted to be a mother, and it's been one of the greatest experiences of my life. But as a creative, I was just like, whoa, you know, like, how do people do this? Like, how do people stay present with their children and still keep their creative fires lit? And how do you make money? And like, how do I ask for more money when it's going to cost me $500 to go leave my kid for two nights, like, or whatever. And I'm a single mom now. So, I mean, there's like extra challenges, but, I just wanted a space to candidly talk about kind of the intersection of creativity and motherhood and healing and spirituality and just all of the things. I mean, motherhood is inherently creative, right? It's like the most creative technically thing that you can do.
Exactly.
And I feel like the mother's voice gets really buried in our culture because we just don't have, like, we don't have the villages, we don't have the, like, we don't have the support. And there's just, I think, like, what mothers have to say is really crucial. Like, I think people need to hear it. The one thing I was so surprised by is, like, I'd be talking about my experience and so many people are just really naive about, like, what it means to be a parent and, like, you, like, can't just leave and be spontaneous. It's like, no, I have to, like, get a sitter and I need to, like, I need to weigh the costs of me being there versus not being there. And, like, so, it's called The Mother and the Muse. And it's just me basically talking about how I navigate all that and what I've been doing to kind of restore my creativity and the tools I'm using and, books I'm reading and how I'm navigating life with as an artist, as a, like, a full-time artist and a single mom. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah. Well, I'm embarrassed to say I haven't heard it yet.
Well, I haven't done too much promoting of it, but there's only five episodes, but yeah,
but I'm gonna look it up
to build it more and get some other art, you know, get some other guests and stuff like that. So
very cool.
In progress. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming to my new house here.
Oh my gosh. And thank you for having me.
Pulling up in my attic.
Yeah, no, I know that you've had this podcast for a while and I've listened to some episodes and I love podcasts.
Yeah, you probably know some of the guests, like Chad. Chad Wright. He's first episode, I think.
Yeah. Gosh, I miss that guy. Great drummer.
Yeah. Great drummer. Great dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on. And we've got to chat about more Nashville stuff off mic.
Yeah, we're neighbors again.
We should
write a song.
Let's do it.
Let's write a non-hit song.
Yeah.
Like something good.
Just something like good that people won't like.
Exactly. That's what I'm into.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for coming.
Thank you, Eric.
I love how she used salad bar as a verb. I think that's I think it's the songwriter in her poking through. I don't know. Maybe all the kids are saying that these days. I missed something, but I love it. It's awesome. I think that Katie absolutely embodies the battle between art and commerce. You know, you can feel her struggle first to find her voice and then to hold on to her voice in a massive world of noise and consumption. And I think there are certain musicians who come to music as a fun way to make a living and approach it as a trade. And there are a lot of opportunities for that, and it's great. And in a way, I think it's almost the easier way to go. The hard way, the other way, is the artist that's trying to make a living at music while pursuing their art. Because you find yourself in places that you would never want to be, like bars and corporate settings that are just so far from creativity and music and the big stages that you dream of, you know. You also find yourself having to manage the feelings of regret and doubt every day. Like, why do I have to do this awful gig, you know, or why did I choose to do this awful gig, or will I ever get from here to where I want to be? I feel like I fall into this category as well, and I definitely know the struggle, but I think she is fighting the noble fight. She's asking the questions that she was born to ask and learning the lessons that she was put here to learn. And I think because artists do this publicly, we all get to learn from their journeys, you know, and that's like a secondary gift that you get to give to the world as an artist. So I don't know. I try to remember that it's really all about the journey, and it's ended up okay for me. You know, it's ended up given me a pretty interesting life, and it was a struggle for a lot of it, but I don't know that I would do it any other way. And it's been fascinating and exhilarating watching her journey, and I can't wait for the next leg. Keep at it. You're killing it. We talked a lot about our mutual friend, Bobby Williams, a great guitar player, singer, producer. He was a really great friend of mine. We played hundreds of gigs together, and he passed away of cancer about 9 years ago now. And so I wanted to just play you out with a song from my record Reinvention. This song's called Like I See You, and I struggled so hard to find the right guitar part for this for a while, and he just picked up the guitar and played it, and it's brilliant. I think it's a great example of his amazing talent and playing. So this is Like I See You, and I hope you had a great time and enjoy the podcast, and I'll talk at you next time.
You hurt, and it kills me. You feel small, but you're larger than life. And my words don't seem to convince you. I wish you could see through my eyes. Could see through my eyes.
Wow, you've made it to the end. I'm hoping it's because you completely enjoyed yourself and are now filled with knowledge and inspiration to move forward with your dreams. If that is the case and you would like to stay informed of new episodes, live events, and general news, please go to divebarrockstar.com and sign up for the mailing list. If you have any questions, comments, corrections, or complaints about anything you hear on the show, please email me at fanmail@divebarrockstar.com and you may even end up on the show. We at the Dive Bar Rockstar podcast, with all of our hearts, thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about dreams.